You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, and this week we'll be looking at China's efforts to improve its higher education sector and a recent wave of concern across Western campuses of the influence of China. Joining me today is our reporter, Ellie Bothwell. Hi, Ellie.
Hi.
And I also spoke earlier with Nian Kai Lu from Shanghai Jiao Tong University about China's endeavors to have a world-class university the likes of Harvard and Oxford. But first, Ellie, you and I were both at the Center for Global Higher Education's annual conference this week in London, where we heard Michael Ignatieff, president of Central European University in Hungary, who is undergoing its own challenges with authoritarian regimes. And he was speaking about just kind of in general the perils of one-party governments on higher education systems and clamping down on academic freedom. And he spoke quite a bit about China specifically as one of the examples of another country where these risks to higher education are seen. What were your takeaways from what he was saying specifically about China?
Yeah, so he was basically saying that academic freedom is, I guess, is quite a complex issue in the country. So he was talking about how, you know, in STEM fields and the natural sciences, universities and researchers are given quite a lot of freedom, but how in the humanities and social sciences, scholars are much more clamped down. And he kind of seemed to be quite sceptical over whether that difference would kind of work for the country. And also about the fact that, you know, a lot of Chinese students now study abroad or have been for a while in countries like the US and the UK, you know, much more liberal governments. And he kind of questioned whether those students, when returning to China, would kind of assimilate back into a much more controlled state. He referred to it as a kind of unstable situation, and he wasn't sure that kind of Xi Jinping was aware of the challenges maybe that this contrast might bring.
Yeah, I remember he spoke about, he's the term a regime bargain, and that was what he was talking about clamping down on the research around the humanities and social sciences, and then trying to present this academic freedom front around the natural sciences, and how those two things don't really merge. It's not the same thing, and it's quite obvious that that's not exactly the same type of academic freedom that we're used to seeing on Western campuses. He was also talking about how a lot of Western universities, maybe in the 1980s and 1990s, were really excited about trying to establish partnerships with China and set up branch campuses in China, and how they expected this kind of inevitable liberalization of politics in China to occur once there was this globalization of higher education, and how with the extension by Xi Jinping of his own power as a one-party leader in China, that liberalization of politics just isn't going to happen like they'd originally hoped.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how he spoke about that in that happening in various countries. So he also drew on Turkey and Russia as well as, you know, Hungary, where he's based, and about the fact that actually one of the issues is that universities have kind of almost been like on the wrong side of politics, and so this liberalisation that they thought would happen, you know, actually they weren't on the side that the public were on. And maybe that kind of that's one of the reasons why it failed. And then there was also some interesting comments from kind of some of the audience members. Someone saying that, you know, this strategy of China's is very successful in terms of its ability to innovate. You know, if the STEM subjects are very open, that might allow kind of innovation and you know, new technologies, but it doesn't necessarily allow kind of creativity. So maybe there's a kind of trade-off there.
Yeah, and just in general, he was just speaking about, quite candidly, I thought, about academic freedom, and how he even admitted that as a university president, he really never even thought about academic freedom until what happened at CEU with the government coming in and passing a law basically requiring them to have a campus in the U.S. if they wanted to continue operating in Budapest, when there's still negotiations are still going on about that. But he said that he never really valued this idea of academic freedom until it was kind of taken away from him.
Yeah, he said some interesting things about how if he was kind of pushed about academic freedom before, he would have talked about it as a kind of privilege of professors, particularly, I guess, tenured professors, and it just means that, you know, the state or the university can't easily fire you, where, rather than a kind of right that actually protects the whole of society. And he said that he thought that, that the general public also see academic freedom as a kind of privilege of academics, and that if universities really want to kind of defend themselves in the 21st century and really fight against authoritarian governments, then they need to kind of convince the public that actually, you know, academic freedom doesn't just mean that they can, you know, write whatever research they want to write. It's actually about protecting the whole of society. It, you know, it means that, you know, it's the way in which people can actually learn anything at all.
Going back to China, that's kind of a concern that you've written about this week in your article for the Times Higher Education magazine, about a closing down of Confucius Institutes across Western campuses. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening?
Yeah, so in various kind of Western countries, there seems to be a kind of crackdown emerging on Confucius Institutes. So the kind of latest example is in the UK. Last month, the Conservative Party Human Rights Commission launched a new inquiry looking at Confucius Institutes, looking at whether there are issues around academic freedom and freedom of speech and human rights in general. And it follows similar moves elsewhere. So in the US, the FBI is investigating Confucius Institutes. It announced that in February. And Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, has urged universities in the state to close down any Confucius Institutes. In Australia as well, it's also been an issue, maybe not specifically so much around Confucius Institutes, but there's certainly been a lot of concern about China's influence. And there's been new kind of anti-treason laws that might, you know, which Confucius Institutes might be sort of caught up in. So yeah, it seems like I mean, obviously, Confucius Institutes have been around for a long time.
They're basically kind of cultural centers, kind of the cultural arm of the Chinese government to try to encourage Chinese language and culture, bit of soft power effort, diplomacy type thing, similar to the British Council or the Goethe Institute.
Yeah, I think the so that's kind of their aim, and they've been operating for, you know, a long time. I think the concern is that what makes it different from something like the British Council is that they operate from university campuses. So, you know, the British Council might have these sorts of courses, but they're kind of separate from universities. And that, you know, Confucius Institutes are kind of funded by the Chinese government. There are concerns, or there have been concerns for a long time, that actually they it's a kind of propaganda, a way of kind of spreading propaganda. And so I guess these sorts of crackdowns have kind of brought that debate again into the public eye. And there are questions over what that means. I mean, obviously, you know, these investigations are ongoing at the moment, so we don't know the outcome of them yet. But, I mean, depending on what the results are from the investigations, it looks like, you know, either the government will impose new regulations on how Confucius Institutes work, or universities themselves might, you know, decide not to renew their contracts.
Mm. And it's also, especially in Australia, the concern seems to be highest there. And there was a recent law proposed about treating Chinese academics as foreign, Chinese academics who are already in Australia as foreign academics?
Yeah, so the idea is about researchers kind of registering publicly as foreign agents,
right,
if they receive foreign funds and if they're engaged in political lobbying. So, you know, that might mean that some people that work at Confucius Institutes might be caught up in that if the activity is kind of seen as lobbying. Quite an interesting change in the debate around Confucius Institutes is that, you know, initially concerns around them came from the left, and they were very much focused on kind of academic freedom. And now a lot of the critics of Confucius Institutes are actually kind of on the political right, and it's much more about kind of concern of China as a state, sort of broader kind of security concerns, broader just kind of concerns around, you know, Chinese people and kind of China's characteristics. So there has been a bit of a shift in the kind of people that are concerned about these institutes. But I did also speak to people who defended these kind of centres. I spoke to Stephen Dunnett, who is Vice Provost for International Education at the University of Buffalo, and he's co-chair of the Board of Advisors at the University's Confucius Institute. And he was he said he didn't think the investigations are going to find, you know, any kind of credible evidence of the accusations against them, you know, that have, and even a film called the In the Name of Confucius, which is about the influence of Confucius Institutes in Canada, and it's kind of quite critical of them. I spoke to the producer of the film, and even she mentioned that actually it's difficult to find any actual evidence of this going on, or enough evidence to kind of, I guess, to say why they should kind of close down altogether.
So it's interesting how it might be reflecting kind of geopolitical times now more than maybe an actual risk.
Yeah, very much so. But obviously, if universities feel that, you know, the governments are really looking into this and really watching how they're behaving, they might decide that it's actually just safer to kind of stop working with China in that way and close down their Confucius Institutes anyway.
Another concern is just the competitiveness of Chinese universities, and the government has increased its investments into its higher education system. I think it was $160 billion this past year, and that's not including another $280 billion in research and development expenditure. So it's definitely making massive investments, at least, to try to improve its higher education sector. Whether or not they're actually being successful at that is yet to be seen. They're also introducing a number of programs like the 485 program, and the most recent iteration of that would be the Double World Class program. They're definitely endeavoring to improve the quality of their higher education institutes, and I think that's making some Western universities perk up their ears and be aware of potential encroaching competition from Chinese universities. Also at the CGHE conference was Nian Kai Liu, who is from Shenghao Jiao Tong University, and I spoke with him about how Chinese universities are trying to close the gap between their performance and those of what we consider world-class institutions. We also discussed the programs that the government has introduced to support universities to do this, like the most recent Double World Class program, some of the pressures that professors and university staff are feeling to meet the challenges of those programs, and also the role that rankings like our own and the academic rankings of world universities, or the Shanghai rankings, which Professor Liu was actually the founder of, what role they could play in helping China try to close that gap. Okay, so the 985 program, the Double World Class program, are these all programs that are kind of evolutions of each other? Are they building on the previous one?
As I said in the presentation, we had started the 211 project. Then a few years later, we started 985. It's two different ones. A few others of this kind of excellency initiative. Then starting from last year, all of these excellence initiatives were merged into one. So the Double World Class. So it's upgraded. I wouldn't say merge, but anyway. So those were stopped. This new and upgraded excellence initiative, only one left. New.
You mentioned a little bit as being an academic, an insider in an institution as these programs are being introduced, and you talked about some of the pressures that academics feel whenever a new program is introduced. Can you expand on that?
The pressure is just too much work, because you need to work. You let's say you will use to publish a professor, individual professor, use to publish two papers every year. But suddenly you are, you know, kind of not required, but pressured to publish three times of that. You can think it's three times the pressure. It's just simple like that. I think this kind of pressure also exists in many of the British, Japanese, or even some American universities that I know. So you just, you know, you have to go through, if you want funding, if you want a good record in your evaluation, if you want to get promoted, well, you have to do this. So that's the pressure for the professors. Yes, I mean, otherwise, if you, and we are working extremely hard. I used to, not I'm getting old, but now, but I used to work 15, 16 hour a day, 7 days a week for many years. Can you think of the pressure? That's the only way you can reduce the gap. if you work 8 hours a day, I mean, all the Chinese professors, can you imagine how to reduce the gap? No way. So the pressure, the reduction of the gap is because of the pressure. So it's pressure for the professors, also for the universities, of course. The present of university is really a lot of pressure for this kind of competition, I would say.
Is that common? Would you say your peers are also working that hard, 15, 16
hours? Not 15 hours. I'm not working 15 hours anymore. I'm getting old. Anyway, there's actually international statistics on the hours of professors working in the different countries, and China was the number one, all among the top three. I think it was the number one, the longest working hours every week. That's by statistical of a large number of universities, not just the top university. If you do a survey of top university, it would be much more than that. So generally speaking, yes, the professors are working overtime a lot.
There's this perception in some of the Western countries that China is this big competitor that is starting to encroach on their authority as leaders in higher education. What's your impression of that?
In terms of world-class university, which I know, I study all the time, that's a long way to go. Maybe in some aspects, some Chinese universities are doing quite well, but in general, still a long way to go.
And you mentioned that some of their institutional, national, and global challenges to reducing that gap.
Yeah.
So this is for a podcast, so our listeners may not necessarily have heard the points that you made. So would you mind just kind of going over those again, some of the key challenges that you identified?
Yeah, the key challenge for at the institutional level be to increase the percentage of professors doing research because of curiosity. I mean, doing curiosity-driven research instead of, let's say, indicator-driven research. I just said earlier that we are, the percentage, I mean, in Chinese, top Chinese universities is increasing. Well, slowly, but increasing. But that of, I would say, British universities is decreasing also slowly, because you now have the professors, not you, professing in British universities also have this kind of pressure of indicator-driven research. You have to produce more journal papers, books, and get more grants. So we are in a different direction. We are increasing, but you are from a very high level, decreasing slowly.
Mm.
That's the main challenge at the institutional level. At the national level, I always say is the research evaluation system. Means everything related to research, grants, initiatives, and platforms on national laboratories, let's say, of all those kind. It's very similar to the first one. To the institutional level, you need, to change from indicator-driven to quality-driven. Quality, I mean, itself, not quality indicators. So it's changing, but at a much slower speed than at the institutional level. Because institutions, only the top ones, are working really hard to change that.
There's another perception that's relatively new of this fear of the influence that Chinese academics might be having as some sort of extension of the current regime in China and the influence that they might be having on the shores of Australia, the US, and the UK. There are a number of Confucius Institutes that are being closed down.
What's your perception on that?
I really don't know much. I have no expertise on this at all because I'm not doing any studies and not read anything of that kind. So the influence outside China, you should know more than I do anyway.
Do you think that is a challenge for your endeavor to tighten the gap?
What do you mean by that? The challenge is two different things. You mentioned about Confucius Institute or other initiatives outside China. It does not have much to do with the initiatives, excellency initiative to build a world-class university. It's just two different things. The government is encouraging or supporting these two or many other different initiatives. So I don't see the relation between these two kind of initiatives.
Okay. I guess my point would be if the perception of partnering with Chinese academics is somehow tarnished, would that then impact the ability for Chinese universities to proceed along this, their progress in achieving excellence?
I don't know. I don't really don't know. I don't think so. I think, again, like myself, I'm doing collaboration with researchers, scholars here in Europe, in the US, all the time. I'm traveling. I think they are going to China. We are having meetings, doing projects, collaborational projects. I don't see any influence.
We both come from rankings organizations.
Yeah, okay.
Do you think that rankings are helping or hurting in this situation? And is there a problem that universities are trying to fit too much into standards that are set by rankings, and maybe there's another definition of excellence that they could be striving toward?
Rankings has its positive influences and negative influences, of course. But generally speaking, I would say much more positive influences than the negative ones. Particularly for Chinese universities. The reason I presented them earlier just because until the mid-90s, or before the ranking, let's say, and of course there's other influence, but the ranking is one of the influences, Chinese universities were not competing internationally at all. A part of the reason I did the ranking is to find out the gap, of course. And then, you know, once you find the gap, you put it, you publish, everybody knows, then people have to work on that to reduce the gap. So in that sense, the influence for Chinese university to compete internationally is a real, really important impact by the rankings, including our ranking and other rankings. But of course, it has negative influences. One of the most mentioned is the universities worldwide are getting, you know, are following these indicators and getting more and more similar, losing their characteristics, their values to some extent. Well, I would say the presence of these universities should have an idea. Well, of course, they have the pressure of getting a higher position in the ranking, but you should also be responsible for the quality of the education and the research themselves instead of ranking positions. So again, there's a balance. So there's some negative influence, but the president, the leadership of the university should do more to reduce this kind of negative influences.
Do you think the day will ever come whenever there is no gap, whenever Chinese universities are competing on par with the best in the world?
I would hope so, or at least. but again, it will take a long time. You know, by indicators, it will take a much shorter time. Many Chinese universities will be in the top 100 of major global rankings in the next few years or next 10 years. But to be truly competitive world-class universities, it takes much longer than that.
And that was Nian Kailu from Shenghao Jiao Tong University. That's about all we've got time for this week. Ellie, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
If you have any questions or comments about our podcast, please do get in touch at sarah.custer@timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.